Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I am very pleased to have not one, but two very special guests doing a little bit of tag team literary and musical interviewing here. I've got L.A. poet, novelist, playwright, and producer Susan Hayden and her son, the 17-year-old singer-songwriter Mason Summit. How are you both doing today?
We're good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, maybe Susan, you could describe your situation right now, where you are exactly and what you're doing, because it's pretty funny.
Yes, we look like a Gregory Crudson photograph. We are, Mason and I are sitting in my car on Bluetooth so that we can both hear you and you can hear us.
Yes.
I'm in my bathrobe and slippers. Mason is dressed. He just ate a moon egg that I made him. And
nice.
We're having our early morning radio interview with you. It's very
you know,
exciting.
just another day in the life of Susan and Mason. Susan Hayden is a poet, novelist, and playwright. Her plays have been produced at the Met Theater, South Coast Reps, Nexus Workshop, Mark Taper Forums, Other Voices, Padua Playwrights, and most recently as a part of Cafe Plays at the Ruskin Group Theater. Her novel, Cat Stevens Saved My Life, was a finalist in the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award with Penguin Press. Her essay, The Soul Section, was recently published in the anthology The Black Body, released by Seven Stories Press. Hayden was the co-producer of the long-running performance fiction series Gas Food Lodging at the Law Studio and is the creator-producer of Library Girl, a literary series currently running the second Sunday of every month at the Ruskin Group Theater in Santa Monica. She is at work on a book of poetry and mixed media montages. Well done, Susan.
Thank you. It's really nice to hear this because most days I just believe I do nothing with my life. So to hear this reminds me that I've actually done a little bit of something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And as for your son, Mason, Mason Summit is a 17-year-old singer-songwriter born right here in Los Angeles. Since age 13, Mason has been playing various venues around Los Angeles. 2012 saw the release of Mason's debut album, Absentee, which is an eclectic collection of songs influenced by Elliott Smith, Buddy Holly, and the Beach Boys. Songs from Absentee have been featured on internet radio shows, including David Lynch's Transcendental Radio. In May 2013, Mason began hosting Mason's Noise Parlor, a quarterly series at Beyond Baroque in Venice, California, to present the talent of other teen musicians and writers. Mason also wrote the musical score for a video promoting the charity Free Arts for Abused Children. He is currently working on an album of new songs titled Loud Music and Soft Drinks. Yes, and again, Mason does nothing to prevent the talent of other teens and musicians and writers. He is all about presenting. So, Mason, great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah. So, Susan, I thought we might begin the show with having you read a poem of yours entitled Paris 2003, which, well, actually, I won't preface it. I'll just let you read it, and then we can talk about it afterwards.
Okay. Paris 2003. Flushed with the energy of art and alliance, the rocket science of materia prima, he takes me by the hand to wisteria and secrets, steals my breath and kisses me like I'm his new mistress, not his old wife. This is our life, and love is earned, sealed with an alchemist's loyalty and candle wax from sticky long nights of burning. Singular as a field holler, a worn-out blues tune written for us alone, yet universal in skin and bone. His attendants, his inscription, a hermetic cabinet of curiosity called home. The boulevard glows with our footprints, stable and so slippery. Walking on ice has never been this easy. Hang on. Husband, man of the house, best friend, any minute this could end.
Now, Susan, I believe you wrote that poem, if I'm correct. I believe that was the first poem that you wrote after the passing of Christopher Allport, your longtime husband and creative partner. Is that correct?
Yes. It's the first thing that came out.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about how Christopher's presence helped to shape your creativity and outlook on life and how his loss has affected your life journey and your creative journey.
Absolutely. I think to understand the magnitude of the loss, it would perhaps benefit to understand the magnitude of Chris, of a human. He was a larger than life. He had what a friend of mine called ECS, excessive charisma syndrome. He was kind of like, do you know that Cordo Maltese, this character from an Italian comic book in the 60s? The character was the son of a sailor and an Andalusian gypsy prostitute who becomes an adventurer, and he's known as the rogue with the heart of gold. And in childhood, he discovers that he doesn't have a fate line on his palm, and so he carves his own fate line with a razor, and therefore he determines that his fate is his to choose. This character has always reminded me of my husband. He wasn't literally any of that, but he was raised by wolves, in a sense. He was left to his own devices at a very young age, and he developed a tremendous presence and power over others because of this, and his energy was palpable, and I met him when he was on stage in a play, a Harold Pinter play, at the Taper, and it was the kind of thing where he walked on stage, I saw him, and it was during a time in my life when I was really involved with the poetry scene in L.A. and reading the 3 times a week, and I didn't get out to the Taper very much because it was just so expensive to get a ticket to a play there. And one of my friends said, "We're going, we're seeing this play." And when he walked on stage, I said, "That's the man I'm going to spend the rest of my life with." I mean, I just saw him, and there was no question about it. And we didn't get together right away, but as the relationship with him evolved and I began to convince him I was the woman for him, he became my editor. And
wow.
I would literally hand anything that I wrote over to him, and he would go through it and correct the pages and make suggestions. And he really elevated my writing to a whole new playing field by his own amazing instincts. He was brilliant. And he reminded me what I meant to say that I wasn't saying yet in my work. And as the years moved on, my creativity, I've always had writer's block, and my creativity really comes in fits and starts, but I relied on him as a resource and an anchor creatively. And I felt like I was his emotional anchor, and I feel like I held the stability of our family together on that level, but he was really the engine and the mascot, and not just us, but to so many friends and collaborators. So that when he died so suddenly, it wasn't just like that the light went out. It was like a massive power outage. It was a community
right.
blackout.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, there was so much to process. With that loss, because when they're lost, I mean, it's a loss is a loss, but when a loss is a sudden loss, it has a whole other set of, and we were really in tremendous shock and trauma, and I was the mother of a young child, Mason, who was 11 years old when Chris was killed, and
right.
he was shattered, and he became at risk, and it was my absolute priority to make sure that he was safe and stabilized, and I put him and his healing before my own, which wasn't even, there wasn't a question about it. It's just what was. There's this writer, one of my favorite writers, Kelly Corrigan, once said that mothering is the first thing of consequence that I have ever done. You can't imagine how seriously I take that, even as I fail you. And, you know, I feel that every day. I do my best, and I always feel Chris there. But she also said, Kelly Corgan also said, you don't really grow up until you learn to live in the world without the people who made it a safe place for you.
Wow.
So for me, I kind of, you know, he and I, it's not like he was the adult and I was the child, even though he was quite a bit older than I was. We were kind of little kids together, he and I. And that learning to grow up and live in the world without him, those words couldn't be truer for me in the journey of not just losing what I consider to be the other side of my heart, but really learning to find my way without him.
Yeah.
And it's been astonishing.
Yeah, well, what were some of those? Yeah, I would imagine that there are fits and starts and stumblings, but also, you know, some really strong and, you know, beautiful, purposeful steps taken as well. What were some of the initial first steps of healing that you and Mason began taking?
Well, I would say that the first thing that we did was, we dove back into our lives.
Good.
I was advised by therapists that the routine was the most important thing, that he needed to get back to school, that he needed to be around his friends, that he needed to be around his teachers. It might have been too soon in reflection. When I think about it now, he probably could have used a month home in bed, you know, but there's something about, I mean, you know, when you lose your family, as you know it, you lose your complete routine, and every relationship changes. And so what you long for is to connect to something you know and that's familiar. And so going back to school and being in your classroom and being around your friends and all of those things, so I got him back into that, got therapists lined up. It took a while for us to get into the place that would eventually really help save our lives, which is this grief center,
right.
Our house, what it's called. But once we got there, you know, they make you wait a few months because you're really in the thick of chaos, and it's hard to process anything. But once we got there, we felt safe in the realm of there were people we could identify with that had been through similar situations. I mean, everybody's story, you think your story is the worst story until you're around everybody else's story, and then you're equalized and you realize that everybody's story is the worst story. And there's a real connectedness that takes place between people in those groups. I just can't say enough about it. And that was, I would say, the beginning of our healing. And the other thing we did right away is we would go to these live events that made us feel alive. We'd go and hear music, plays, we'd go to readings. There was something about that felt like it was really in the spirit of our family, as it had always been. I mean, Chris and I had been taking Mason to live events that we were in or that friends of ours were in since he was a baby. And part of that was that, you know, it was too expensive to have a babysitter. And part of it was that we wanted him to be exposed to this and that this was who we were and this was what we knew he was going to be, you know. And and so it felt familiar and it felt important to get out there and be connected to other people again and to not isolate.
Yeah. So, Mason, I could ask you a similar question as well. You know, I'd imagine that your father was a huge inspiration for you picking up the guitar. Is that correct?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. What would you say you've learned from him in your approach to music, to art, and life in general?
Well, he was a very confident person, and I think that kind of rubbed off on the people around him, definitely on me. He would take me to open mic nights around the corner at the coffee shop starting when I was around 8 or 9, and he taught me my first chords, so really laid the foundation for me writing and performing today.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you should say confidence because, you know, one of the things that strikes me about you whenever I've seen you perform, you are one of the most fearless and present performers, you know, that I've ever seen. And you know, when I think back on my life, when I was 17 years old, stumbling around the sticks of New Jersey, I look at you and I think about myself, and I was just like, man, I wasn't even close to having that kind of confidence or presence. I was just kind of stumbling around in a haze. So, you know, it obviously looks like that confidence has rubbed off on you, because you are just fearless, and I really love that about you. You know, why don't we go ahead and play one of your songs from Absentee. This is actually the title track from your album, Absentee. So let's go ahead and listen to that now.
Thanks.
Down as an absentee with a snowflake smile that could have fooled me. I hope you're better, feeling free since you've fallen away now from the line. I wonder how your final breath was stolen and replaced with death. Cold cotton inside your lungs, I can't think about it. By morning light, and you lay down on a bed of nails to find out just what pain entails. A lesson that seems so worthwhile, yet I'm the one with scars. 'Cause this desertion was never planned, but sometimes things get out of hand. Absentee, I think you understand, or else you will in time. I fell asleep, you said goodnight, but we lost you by morning.
And that was Absentee by Mason Summit off his 2012 release, Absentee. Mason, what was the inspiration for that track?
Well, that song is about my dad, and I thought it was the strongest track, so that's why I made it the title. And it's not really like an in loving memory of song. It's more of an angry song, and
yeah.
That's because that was one of the primary feelings that I felt for a long time, especially in the beginning aftermath, was more anger at my dad, mm-hmm. probably more than anything else. And so I thought it was okay to express it. And musically, it's influenced by The Doors and other 60s garage rock.
Yeah. There's that sort of Ray Manzarek sort of cool kind of keyboard in there that's really, it's really It's really nice. You know, well, speaking of inspiration, you know, when I've seen you perform live and I've heard different recordings, you know, sometimes I hear different influences like Elliott Smith to Billy Bragg to Roddy Frame from Aztec Camera, you know, all truly tremendous artists. And I'm curious, what are some of the particular aspects of certain artists that inspire you, and how do you go about taking those elements to create a song and make it your own?
Well, Elliott Smith is probably my biggest influence, and I think a lot of it is unconscious, subconscious, just from listening to someone so constantly that it definitely affected the way I wrote, even if I wasn't consciously trying to emulate Elliott Smith. And also way earlier when I was in elementary school, I would listen to Johnny Cash and Buddy Holly and The Doors. And so sometimes I'll write like a rockabilly song and I'll be like, where am I coming from here? And then I'll realize that it's just ingrained in me from when I was much younger. Lately I've been listening to the Beach Boys and Elvis Costello, and definitely taking some harmonies. And lyrically, Elvis Costello is just mind-blowing. So I've been, trying to do a little bit of that. And so sometimes I'll write a song and I don't know really who it sounds like. And I played one the other night, and then someone came up to me and was like, that sounds a lot like early Elvis Costello. And that turns out to be what I was going for, I guess.
Yeah. Now, pretty much every time I've seen you perform, it's been solo. But, you know, listening to Absentee, it begs this question. Do you ever perform with a band, or do you plan on doing that? Or?
Well, for Absentee, I think the people that heard it were like, wow, it's not all acoustic. But even when I'm writing the songs, I'll think of what the band arrangement would be. They're always intended to be band songs, if that's how they're... And I don't have my own band to perform live with. I do have guys that I bring into the studio to record with, and my next album is featuring a lot more of the band vibe. And but I am in a duo called The Clowns Will Eat Me. We've been posting demos on SoundCloud. We have a gig at Genghis Cohen on the 12th, Thursday the 12th.
Oh, nice.
And we've been kind of, what I like about collaborating with someone else is that the product that we create is like nothing that we would do on our own, respectively.
Yep.
And so we've been just layering a bunch of harmonies and kind of some jazz chords and acoustic parts and digging it.
Nice, nice. So, Susan, back to you. You know, I've mostly known of your work as a poet, yet you've written a number of stories, short plays, and a screenplay. How would you say these types of writing are similar or different to how you approach a poem?
Well, I guess when I sit down to write a poem, it stems from an urgency and an imagery, and there's an impulse and then an unfolding. And with playwriting, it's more about eavesdropping. Like, years ago, I used to hang out with one of my playwriting teachers, this guy, John Stepling, and we went on a road trip to Vegas, and we were in this coffee shop in the outskirts of Nevada surrounded by all these kind of hungover types, and one of them was rambling on about his past, and Stepling turned to me and said, are you listening to this? You know, don't you see there's a 1/4 play in everything? And I never forgot it. And so, like, for plays, I listen to others when they don't know I'm listening, and I write dialogue in my head, and then sometimes it takes shape as a monologue or a play, and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, I feel like there's a knowing in me that when I sit down to write, that it's clear what form the writing's going to take. Like, I have a feeling when I sit down to write a poem that it's going to be a poem. When I sit down, I know, you know, if I'm thinking about, I have this dialogue in my head, I'll know it's a play. A short story, on the other hand, comes from me posing a question to myself. Like, for example, why did the girls in sixth grade all decide one day to not like me anymore? And that propelled me to explore. It actually propelled a whole novel. And so there are different approaches, but I don't know. It's been, I go through phases. I mean, I really wanted to, people, I had a friend say to me, really, it was in the first few months after Chris died, you have to write this memoir about what happened. You have to write it now. And I thought, you know, I can barely, I felt like I was, like I had gauze in my ears and I was kind of being held underwater and then a crane fell on my head. I mean, I just, I had these physiological symptoms of weakness, dizziness, lethargy, and I had an adrenaline at the same time. I wanted to be, I wanted to express myself creatively, and I did, but I couldn't write the memoir of what happened because I was, I'm still processing what happened, you know, I mean, to this day.
Right.
And, but I found that first, after he died, I would go over to Cafe Plays at the Ruskin, and I wrote several short pieces because I could express it. I could express it, what I was going through, in dialogue more easily than in that, the deeper place of sitting down and writing a poem. And then, at a certain point, my feelings and my process could only come out as poetry. And so that's kind of what it's been since. Like, for the last few years, I feel like that's the form that it's, I mean, they're really prose poems. They're more like story poems. But that's the form that my writing has taken. It's kind of like back to where I began. It's how I started writing. So I have written and experimented in all these different forms, and I do trade off, but I would say, like, in my soul, I'm a poet first. I'm not an academic. I'm a college dropout, and but this is just how I express myself in these prose poems first, before anything.
Yeah.
And I often create, like, a collage of images before I start a project, before I start writing, to organize my thoughts. If I'm just sitting with myself, by myself, I don't necessarily know how I feel about something. I can think I know how, but I reveal myself to me through making collages and making notes in a journal, and that's how I find out how I really feel about something.
So you produce and curate a pretty rocking monthly literary event here in L.A., Library Girl, which actually happens tonight at the Ruskin Theater in Santa Monica. What were the events surrounding Library Girl's creation? What purpose do you feel it serves in the L.A. arts scene and literary community?
Well, you know, I did produce that series with my husband in the 90s called Gas Food Lodging, which was performance fiction. It was actors and directors coming together to take fiction right off the page and dramatize it. And so I had a history with that and producing other events as well. My first production was a tribute to Raymond Carver. And I came from the only classes I ever took as a writer were when I went to the Paduay Hills Playwrights in the 80s. And I had a teacher there. There were many great playwriting teachers there. But one of them is this guy, John O'Keefe, who's a solo performer. And he made this statement once in the group of students. He said something like, if you feel like there's something missing from your life or that you're not being included in something, you know, you need to create it yourself. Create what's missing. Don't wait for someone to ask you to do it. And this was like the DIY movement before the DIY movement. I mean, in those days, in the 80s, if you rented a space and put on a play, you were considered a vanity production and you were looked down upon. But it really stuck with me, and it inspired me to create events. And so, like I said, you know, I produced a tribute to Raymond Carver in the late 80s, and Chris and I, when we got together in the 90s, did this show off and on at the Law Studio in Hollywood. And then I kind of let the producing thing go. Every now and then I'd pull something together, but it was quite time-consuming. I was raising Mason, writing a novel, and I kind of stepped away from the poetry scene. And then after he died, before he died, actually, I produced Chris's one-man show called Back Road Home. I'd always told Chris that he had a one-man show in him, that he needed to person the brilliant solo performance teacher, and he's kind of like the Spalding Gray of L.A., this guy Paul Link. He took his class, they created the show, and I produced it at the Ruskin. It was my introduction to the Ruskin Theater, which is really right around the corner from where we live in Santa Monica at the airport. And I produced his show. It was a huge success. We didn't do a full run, but we would do it kind of like once a month, and I always passed the house. And after he died, Mikey Myers and John Ruskin from the theater said to me, you really should have your own show. And it's something like I might have thought of, but that I wouldn't have done at that time. And they encouraged me to create it, to start it. And so I wasn't quite sure what I wanted it to be at first. I knew it was a great idea, but I just didn't know what form it would take. But it became a way to reconnect to my former community, the community I had before I met Chris, community that I had sustained peripherally, but that I wasn't as much part of, that I wanted to recreate. And so I had this urge to do something that was the opposite of technology, like the opposite of disconnect. I wanted to create a space where people could come together and like a place of wonder and amazement, where artists could gather and exchange their stories, not in an improvisational way, but in a formatted way. I didn't know what exactly would happen at first with it. I invited comics and performance-y-type poets. And as it evolved, it really became more like the library. It kind of got more, it got more serious, more contained, which I really prefer for this show. I'm in my fifth year now. And it's something, it just gives me something to look forward to every month. It's like every month it's a different show. Every month I create a new show, and it's different than the other shows, based on a theme, and appreciate it. It's kind of like when you throw a party and you don't know if it's working or not, you know?
Right.
I mean it. I mean, you don't
no,
know.
No, it's true. I know.
To measure it.
Well, it does actually have a party feel to it to some degree. I mean, it's definitely bringing people together. It's a sense of community, and it's a really beautiful thing.
I mean, I feel like I had mentioned before, it's the live events that really kept us going in the beginning after what we went through, What I call like stretching time. You can't really stop time, but you can stretch it. And I feel like there's a real, grief makes you hungry, and there was a real need for me to feel alive again. Because I felt like, you know, certainly, and I feel like, you know, I froze too inside. Someone said to me, he was in an avalanche, but you were in the landslide. And I, just to be able to emerge from that, the only thing that made me feel better was to be at these places, not to go and sit in a dark movie theater and watch something that had already been decided, but to be in a place where I didn't know what was going to happen next, but in the best way, you know?
Right.
There was, and so to be able to be a part of creating something like that and turn it into an exchange is a really important thing. And I'm grateful. I'm so grateful that people like it and get it and show up every month. It's such a gift.
Now, Mason, would you say would you share that sentiment in regards to Mason's Noise Parlor, as far as, you know, one of the reasons you created that event to bring people together?
Yeah,
or what was
Sorry, what?
I was just going to say, if you could talk about it, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. Well, of course, I was influenced by going to Library Girl since I was little, and Poetry in Motion at Beyond Baroque, and my series is at Beyond Baroque. And it's kind of similar to Library Girl, but we have less performers doing longer sets, and it's both a lot of music and words. It's for teenagers. And that's because I know so many talented people at my school and outside of my school who really don't get the opportunity to perform because, I mean, even though we're in L.A., of course, all the clubs have this ridiculous system of, like, $200 minimums to be able to play there and 21 and over. And so this is really just to build the community of young artists. It's all ages, of course. The prices are low. And it's just people that should be known.
Nice. Nice. You know, well, obviously a tremendous inspiration to both of you, you know, Christopher Allport, whose name's been coming up again and again in this show, an extremely talented and soulful human being. I want to actually play one of his songs, which is called Go Round Again. Let's listen to that right now.
Okay, great.
Saw the face of my friend on the news today. Another good man up and slipped away. He left a wife, two kids, and bills to pay. Lord, won't you let me go around? Oh, Lord, let me go round again before I disappear in the dust and the wind. Before they lay my bones in the cold, cold ground. Lord, won't you let me go around? I want to swim in the river, walk in the woods, maybe find time to do somebody good and shine a little light in my neighborhood. Lord, won't you let me go around? Oh, Lord, let me go around again before I disappear in the dust and the wind. Before they lay my bones in the cold, cold ground. Lord, won't you let me go around? Well, I made some love, I want to make more. Never was the money I was working for. I lit my drink before they shut that door. Lord, won't you let me go around? Oh, Lord, let me go around again before I disappear in the dust and the wind. Before they lay my bones in the cold, cold ground. Lord, won't you let me go around? Well, the preacher's got an answer, I said, good for him. I never put my faith in original sin. I dance through the blood beneath my skin. Lord, won't you let me go around? Oh, Lord, let me go around again before I disappear in the dust and the wind. Before they lay my bones in the cold, cold ground, Lord.
And that was Christopher Allport with Go Round Again. You know, Christopher's presence, his humanity and soulfulness really come through in that song. You know, I didn't know Christopher. I mean, I know him mostly through hearing the two of you talk about him, and, you know, so much of what you say really just comes out in that song. It's really quite amazing. I don't want to say he's transparent in that way. He really sort of wears his beauty on his sleeve in a song like that. It really just shines through. What's that?
I was going to say, you know, this song was written just a few months before he died, and it's wow. Kind of startling to listen to it now because it was such a foreshadowing. It was like something in him knew. I mean, yeah. I don't even know how, but it feels like, how could you write a song like that? He was thinking about his mortality in a big way. He just turned 60, which doesn't seem old at all, especially if
right.
I get older. It doesn't seem
right.
that old at all, getting close.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of like, you know, it's like it was it's like it makes you really think, how could he have known?
Yeah.
Because he's just saying, you know, give me another chance. And he was so much about, and he was really an example. He was that Zen cliche of not wasting time, of living every second. And it was exhausting. I mean, it filled everybody's lives up, but it was, at times, it was just exhausting to be around because there was no downtime.
Yeah.
It was just nonstop. And, which gives us solace, I think, you know, when we think about it. It's not like he was sitting around, you know, gazing at his navel. I mean, he really lived his life.
Yeah.
So quickly and fully.
Well, which is something that both you and Mason do as well. I mean, that, you know, when I was reading your bios at the beginning of the show, you two are very busy, but not just doing busy work. I mean, the two of you were just out in the community doing really deep, good work, you know, bringing people together. So, you know, that carries on. That carries on through the two of you. Susan, I was hoping you could read another poem for us.
Sure. Hold on a second. Let me see what I have here. I have a poem that I had been struggling with since he died, it'll never be complete to me, but it's what it is. It's what it is. I'll just read it as it is, as a work in progress. It's called, well, it has a couple titles. One of the titles is About a Widow, and the other is That Country Ways. I haven't really decided on it yet, but it reflects what we've discussed in the last several minutes. You think you belong to someone. You write your story in indelible ink. You think, together we're collective. You tell him, my love stays. Magnetized by his backcountry ways, sugar in the raw, the awe of hubris, the wilderness of the heart stripped. You've gripped a glacier. There's beauty in the imperfection, a cross-section of city and country, field and stream, a mountain man with a sheltered dream. And you find a light to burn for and against, this naked sword fight of a marriage, the so-called you and me, the no one else matters plea, the push-me-pull-you willingness bond, a magic wand that speaks in tongue with a dirty mouth. South of here, west of there, where sameness is your splintered rock, as you unlock reservoirs of each other's ancient history, a trail map to the good, the bad, the ugly. Where the we equals us, and the us makes your every truth hold meaning. Every truth holds meaning, even as your cake cracks. You snap back, lack transforms. Shapeshift and adjust, trust in the permanent press, invest in the hedge fund. You're married. You're a wife for life. Elevation 15,000 feet, but never far from home. You are not alone with his backcountry ways. You think you belong to someone. You want to belong to someone. Yet when you marry a man who builds caves of ice with his bare hands, no compass, no map, no beacon, off-piste, a movable feast in fresh powder, making first tracks, ignoring the watches, the warnings, the weather forecast. When you do such a thing, you're asking for it. You've written your story in invisible ink. Sink into the days as they add up. His backcountry ways a mirror of everything he believes in, even as he hears what he calls a winter wind howling through the trees. Please, someone help before he makes the smooth telly turns of his last run, before he's buried alive without his breath, the bulletproof one facing his own death. And you, always certain and uncertain that the end, the place you wished to extend past middle age, was around the bend. After the unfolding of your plans, there were so many, so many plans. You think you belong to someone, but he got frozen in time in the last seen area, in a dull hysteria of backcountry ways, a maze of rock and snow, a crash cart of false ego. The fallout of precipitation and debris. His legacy? Unpredictable, rugged terrain, leaving only the unnameable pain. Unnameable pain. and the reframing of your life, for you are no longer a wife, but the star of a one-woman show, the one you said you'd never write, about a widow. He's left, though you could almost hear him in winter wind and in the trees, his pleas that whisper in your ear. Nearer than you think, I made that vow that you belong to yourself now. You belong to yourself now.
Wow. Wow, that was beautiful. So something you mentioned earlier, Susan, and this is actually a question for the two of you. Whenever you find yourself perhaps struggling with a particular poem or Mason with a particular song, are there do you have a particular process that you do to try to work through that struggle to get to the end of the particular creation? Do you just sit it aside, or how do you deal with that?
Do you want to answer?
Sure, I'll go first. Well, I've been experiencing some writer's block that has just lifted with two new songs, and sometimes if it's not coming to me, I'll try and force it, but usually the results are kind of contrived and forced, of course, and a lot of times I'll start a song and then it'll be too good to finish because I'll worry that the rest of it won't be as good as the part that I've already written. So really, I'm a little too reliant on bursts of inspiration.
That runs in the family. I mean, I'm probably the most undisciplined writer that ever existed. But I was thinking about this, listening to Mason. And your questions that we had discussed, you know, before the show, kind of like in thinking about sort of like what influences and inspires,
right.
For me, like when there's a lull now and I'm incapable of creating anything, go back to my earliest influences, my original, the original poetry of my life, which are the singer-songwriters of the 70s. And I always find something when I turn on music that I love. They are the Joni Mitchell, Cass Stevens, Jackson Browne, Bob Dylan, Gordon Lightfoot, you know, those guys, men and women, they were the first poets of my life. And I will go to them first before I'll go to a book of poems.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. Inspired. Yeah. They just opened,
yeah.
They opened the door for me. And they did then, and they do now. They continue to. I mean, of course, there are so many writers that also inspire me and infuse me, infuse my work. But I just find that, and I'm so lucky because, you know, Chris was always playing, he played the fiddle and the guitar and the mandolin, and there was always just constant chaos in the house, as I mentioned. I mean, it was just that he would do like four or five things at once. There was like a pot of some food cooking, and there was the ball game was on, and we still had our dog then, and he'd be screaming. And you know, there was just this kind of whirlwind of sound. And when he died, it was like this harsh silence. And slowly, you know, Mason picked up his guitar and started filling our home with music again.
Nice.
And it's so beautiful. I'm so lucky that I get to have that, you know, I can turn on the radio or turn on iTunes or whatever, but I also have guitar in the next room and these songs that are being created constantly.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Speaking of beautiful music and Mason, why don't we go ahead and, Mason, let's play another one of your, another track from Absentee. This one is called Walk on Water. I could walk. And that was Mason Summit with Walk on Water from the album Absentee, which was released last year, 2012. Mason, when writing, generally what comes first for you, music, lyrics, or some combination of the two?
Well, I guess mostly I like to write it them both at the same time, because it's very hard for me to write a lyric and then fit it over a new melody, or vice versa, just create a melody on its own and then add lyrics to it. And it happens sometimes, but usually I really like to just have one song in one sitting of writing. Lately I have been doing that, but I usually, when I sit down to write, do both at the same time, and then maybe stop it. Maybe I have a verse or a chorus, and then come back to it later and keep going, writing the two concurrently, definitely.
Do you feel that, like, if you come up with a certain melody or a chord change or something, that it'll invoke a certain kind of lyric, or is it as spontaneous as that, or how is it when you pair the two?
I think that definitely is the case, because music without words can definitely spark certain feelings in everyone. But I also like to kind of contradict that sometimes and do something unexpected, like put a sad lyric over a kind of jaunty chord progression,
yeah,
or vice versa. And,
You mentioned Elvis Costello earlier. He was very good at that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
He could write some of the most biting lyrics over some of the most pretty melodies.
That's so true, and I think that's more effective than just having everything be a monotone.
Elliot Smith did that too, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Susan, someone you mentioned earlier, Cat Stevens, you wrote a novel entitled Cat Stevens Saved My Life, which was a finalist in the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award with Penguin Press. Can you talk a little about that?
Absolutely. I wrote the book. I wrote the first 100 pages when I was pregnant with Mason, so it was quite a while ago. The book wrote itself. I mean, I had so much to say about this certain period of time in my life, which was in the mid-70s, early to mid-70s in the San Fernando Valley, coming of age. And I needed to work out a few things, and so I did it by writing this novel instead of going to therapy. And it was amazing. I mean, I checked into Holly Prado's workshop, which I couldn't say enough about. She's such a brilliant teacher and friend and poet. And I brought the first 100 pages, and then The book was like, 750 pages by the time I finished it. What was interesting was I got an agent while I was still in the middle of writing it. Someone recommended me to an agent in New York, and, I ended up, of course, having to cut the book in more than in half. But it was contemporary fiction. It was intended to be for adults. And this, again, was in the 90s, in the late 90s. And so at that time, young adults hadn't really... It wasn't what it is right now, and it was just starting to be. And so, I wrote this book, not as a young adult book, but I wrote it with an 11-year-old sixth grader talking about adult subject matters. And it was kind of raunchy and for its time. And I felt like every time I rewrote it, as suggested by others in the literary world, I kind of dumbed it down, which was really hard for me. Because I liked the rawness of what came out initially, and but as it got submitted, it made the rounds. It came very close to selling. First time out, Warner Books almost bought it. Ironically, the woman who was most interested in the book ended up buying a book called Good Grief. And I remember thinking, who wants to hear a story about a widow? This story is more interesting. I didn't have a clue, what was in store for my life. She chose that book over mine. It was really between the two, and kind of haunting. But I kind of let it go, and then I got another agent in New York, another great agent, and I rewrote the book. It was suggested that it be a young adult book, and what they call a crossover. So I made her, I made the girl, the narrator, older. I made her 14 years old and in ninth grade. And it was okay. I mean, I didn't love the fact that I made her older and that she was in ninth grade, but I did it. I kind of accommodated the expectation of this agency. And, I mean, it really just tore my soul apart, you know, just kind of like, I felt like Barton Fink or something. I mean, just
right.
Kind of like you have this idea and this impulse to create something, and then, you know, it just wasn't fitting in, like, with publishers. They weren't getting it, and it was falling into a crack between adult and young adult. And even when I adapted it to the young adult market, supposedly, it still, like, to them, it sounded like an adult book still. So anyway, so yeah, so then I got an agent in Los Angeles. It was kind of like a lot of false starts with it, a lot of interest, a lot of letdown. But I read from it a lot, and I continue to read from it sometimes when I'll be asked to do a reading somewhere. And I read from it at Dutton's Bookstore when it was still around. I read from it at Beyond Baroque. I read from it kind of all over town, Poetry in Motion, and people really like it. They really take to it, and they'll always say, it's a movie. It captures a certain time, which is now 40 years ago. In the 70s, when the kids were the adults and the adults were the kids, the children were the products of parents who were come of age in the 40s and 50s and raised kids in the 60s and really missed the fun, missed the wild times. And then, you know, when the 70s hit, they kind of lost their minds and got into, you know, not free love, not my parents, but, you know, just this kind of like they weren't as present as they could have been for the lives of their kids. And so TV was our babysitter, and we kind of had to find our way. And the book actually is about friendship and identity and belonging and loss and strength and survival. The last line of the book, it says something like, you know, some pretty bad things happened, and I got through it somehow. I'm not giving up, but going on. It was like, I wrote that line before I even knew what was ahead for me. But I guess the character in the book and I have always had a kind of inner strength that has gotten me through some pretty hard times. And the character isn't a victim, and I've never allowed myself to be a victim of my circumstances. And that's just really an ethic of our family. I think Mason's the same way. You know, we never, right, ever wanted anybody to feel sorry for us. We just wanted to continue growing. And I call grief a broken gift. You have to look at it and say, okay, this happened. This isn't going to ruin us. What can we take from this? How can we move forward? And the novel kind of reflects that spirit even before any of this happened. So it's still around, but not around. I didn't, you know, then self-publishing really became kind of demystified. And now, like, everybody's self-publishing, and it's not looked down upon in the same way as it was when I was trying to get the big book deal. And so I've been encouraged to self-publish it or to try to find a smaller publisher. I feel like, you know, you and I are in this such a great community of writers and friends who have their own presses, and I haven't really gone that route yet. I haven't really taken another look at the book and said, but I've been encouraged to. I feel like I need, it's on my list of, you know, it's on my things to do list of just go back to the book and complete that. It's important for that book to be published, and even if I do it myself or with a smaller press, I feel like completion is such an important part of art. And it's just like, you know, it's just a manuscript, you know, with a spiral next to my bed. And I'd like to be able to give it to people, you know, this is something that I did, you know, this is really important to me. Yeah, so it remains to be seen, but I think that it does need completion.
Right. Well, speaking of completion and giving something to people, you have a short play that's going to be in a festival on December 13th through 15th at the Lost Studio in Hollywood. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes, actually, that's next. It's the play was written when my husband Chris was still alive. It's called Tomorrowland, and it was written, there's this thing at the Ruskin, as you mentioned earlier, called Cafe Plays, where you get together on, it's the third Sunday of the month. My series is the second Sunday of the month there, Library Girls. Cafe Plays is the third Sunday of the month. And the writers, five writers, get together in a room in the morning, and they're handed envelopes with headshots and and a theme, and they create a cafe play for 10 minutes based on the theme. And I wrote this play 6 years ago. They kind of rigged it, and I got my husband as one of the actors, and I wrote this play. The theme was The Night Before Christmas. I wrote this play called Tomorrowland, and he ended up starring in it with another actor named Jim Roof, and they did it at the Ruskin. You know, basically opening night is you write the play in the morning, it's performed that night, and they're memorized. These guys are off book, and they actually have the props, and they have the lighting, and they have the music that you wrote that you wanted in it. It's amazing how they pull it together so fast. So that play was written then, and at the time it was directed by Dan Attias, an incredible TV director my husband's best friend, and one of his best friends, and it just kind of all fell together, and it was performed at 7:30, and then at 9:00 they call opening night at 7:30, closing night 9:00, and then it was picked as one of the best of cafe plays later in the year. So I actually have a DVD of it, which is my treasure, and I put it away, and you know, occasionally Mason and I would watch it, and then I was at a play, just at a play a few weeks ago, and I ran into an old friend of mine, Cinda Jackson, who owns the Lost Studio where Chris and I used to produce our performance fiction show, and she asked me if I had anything for her Christmas stuff, a year there at this theater. It's a beautiful theater on La Brea next to American Rag, and so they do this short play festival. Plays are like anywhere from 3 to 10 minutes, and my play is like 14 minutes. But I submitted Tomorrowland, and it was a really interesting challenge to recast my husband, you know, to recast this play with new actors. And I am thrilled with it. It has a completely different energy. It's almost about something else with these two actors. But these guys, Christopher Pennock and Jim Storm, they acted together in Dark Shadows, which was a show that was on, you know, 45 years ago. They met, and they were stars of this show that I used to watch when I was a little girl. They haven't acted together since. I mean, they've been really good friends ever since. But I didn't realize how close they were. And I cast them together, and they're giving this play a whole new meaning.
Wow.
Nice. Yeah, so it's one of, you know, there are 9 writers in the evening, and 11 short plays, and my play is in the first half. And it's felt so good to be back interacting with actors, and it's inspired me to continue work on this larger project that I've been kind of chipping away at, that I'm creating with this man that I mentioned earlier, Paul Link, who developed and directed Chris's one-man show. He's helping me. He's collaborating with me on a piece about what happened to us, to our family, in the loss of Chris. And so it's been – just doing this play has pulled me back into theater, and I'm so grateful for that. It's important, and you'll be seeing that play hopefully next year.
Oh, yes.
This multimedia theater piece that I'm writing that – you know, maybe will take place at the Ruskin, and it's going to have the piece that I'm writing. It's going to have poetry and music, and Mason's going to be in it, and I'm hoping for this actor that is in this play, Tomorrowland, this guy Chris Pennock, I'm hoping that he'll play Chris Allport's ghost. They were friends and mountaineers together, and it's really beautiful that he can be a part of my work now. Yeah, and there'll be a poet and a widow and a psychic, and it's going to be interesting.
Nice.
I hope I can wait it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Mason, back to you for a moment. You know, you're still relatively young, you know, the ripe old age of 17, and I'm curious, do you have any particular older mentors that you look to for guidance with your songwriting, your creativity, or life in general?
Definitely. I've taken some songwriting classes, Peter Case's songwriting class
nice.
At McCabe, and one-on-one with Xander Schloss of the Circle Jerks, and Sean and Xander, the duo. And I worked with a producer before I before I decided to self-produce my album. And he was kind of a mentor, but we weren't really on the same path musically. And so I then recorded my album with John McDuffie at Groovalator Studios in Echo Park. And we just talk about gear all the time and talk about how the songs should be. And I think that's definitely been inspiring. My brother Andrew, who's a poet and a great musician, although he's shy about expressing that, he's definitely an inspiration in terms of his composure and his eloquence. I really look up to him.
Nice. Why don't we go ahead and play another track from Absentee? This one is called What We'll Become.
Thank you.
Trash, would you cool me? If the rains came down and made me rust, would you throw me over in disgust? Would you polish me up again? These shadows of doubt are keeping us down, but I'll go and the concrete split. I'd pull you out from under it. I'd pull you out, 'cause I need you more than I need myself. And the truth is, I don't wanna screw things up again. These shadows of doubt are keeping us down, but I'll go up late and wait for me. Would you wait for me? These shadows of doubt are keeping us down, but I'll go on just to see what we'll become. No, it don't end here. With any luck, we'll just
And that was Mason Summit with What We'll Become from Absentee. This is a question for the two of you. We're getting close to the end of our time. I have to wrap things up soon, but I definitely want to hear from both of you on this point. You know, you both have given the LA community so much with your performances and producing events, Susan, with Library Girl, Mason, with Mason's Noise Parlor. What would you say that the LA community has given back to each of you? Susan, why don't we start with you?
Well, I feel like everything that I've given, supposedly given to the community, I've received back to the thousandth power. Intimacy and connection, the exchange, it's been invaluable to me. I don't, I, it's I never feel like I'm doing the giving, you know? Like, I feel like I am exchanging with other people, and it sustains me. And it's like a home that I left and came back to, and it was always waiting for me. I mean, I was so much a part of this literary community before I got together with Chris, and it started to kind of dwindle because the marriage was time-consuming, and he was a lot, and he took up a lot of energy and time. It was great, but I couldn't sort of – it was hard for me to find both, to be in both, to have my married life, my domestic life, raising a child, family, you know, friends, other moms with kids. I mean, I felt like I was, as I have said before, sort of straddling the line between, like, the bourgeois and bohemia. Like, I couldn't find my way. I was both. And I really missed my poet friends, and I missed being a part of readings and live events. And so I just saved my life. I believe that it's really helped save my son's life. We have such a rich community of people here in LA. I mean, you and I are a part of this together, Rich, and we're so lucky. I just can't thank everyone in it enough for embracing Library Girl, welcoming me back. There's just a real open-heartedness to the people that I know in this world of writers and poets and I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of like oozing with gratitude about it. And you know, and it was like when I was starting out as an actress, and it wasn't really working for me. I wasn't very good, and I stumbled into the poetry section of the Bodhi Tree, Hughes Branch, which is on the street where I lived, and it was like one of those turning points where my life changed. I started to go to readings, and everything shifted, and it's been there ever since. And even if I've come in and out of it, when I come back to it, it's always there. And feel judgmental, they feel welcoming. And there's room for everybody. There's room for another person to do a series. There's room for another poet. Like, it feels like less competition than in the acting world, the theater world. It feels like there's just, we all make room for each other and celebrate
right.
each other. Maybe I'm romanticizing it, but that's how I feel about it. That's my philosophy about it. I feel inclusive about it.
Yeah. What about you, Mason? What would you feel that the LA community has given back to you?
I would probably echo my mom's sentiment. You know, I couldn't produce this Mason's Noise Parlor show without the surplus of talent in my community and without people coming to see it. I couldn't do my own solo shows without an audience or produce my recordings without people wanting to hear it. So that's something I'm really appreciative of, is that anyone cares about what I'm doing, and people do, apparently, and I like to give this opportunity to people to perform, but it's also my opportunity to see and hear them perform. So I think it's mm-hmm. definitely a full 50-50 exchange.
Nice. Susan, do you have a poem that you could... I want to have you do a poem, and then I want to pay tribute to Christopher before the end of the show and play one more of his songs. But do you have a poem that you could share with us before we close out the show?
Sure. I'm going to read a poem that I've read around town a lot, but I feel like it. Yeah, I'm going to read this poem full of life. It's for Chris. And so I wonder, will I ever walk in snow again? Begin to let go of the hand of my frozen man, lured by powder and ice, enticed and betrayed by crystalline flakes. Will I let another skate on the cracked lake of my heart, reshaped and newly landscaped by nature's peril? It's Thanksgiving time, and the radio is playing Christmas Carol. I can smell last year's goose like it was cooked last night. Am I right to save the sorrel, the hand-knit scarves of prickly wool? Full of life I am, and thankful. I had no idea I had it all, until now. And how I have even more of an awareness of what came before the whiteout conditions. 10 Novembers ago, we drove to a backcountry cabin in a snowstorm, kept warm by kerosene and skin on skin. Good night, I love you, we said again and again, then fell into slumber under our winter coats. By morning, he was reading John Muir quotes and teasing me about talking in my sleep. You keep doing it, but this time it was the most beautiful word. I heard it and awoke. When you spoke, you said, flurry, flurry. A brief light snowfall, the call of a sudden gust of wind, a stirring mass as of leaves or dust, a shower, a powerful burst of commotion, a stir. And we were just that, only we didn't know it, full of life and so thankful.
That was beautiful. That was truly beautiful. As I said before, I want to close. I want to close today's show by, you know, paying tribute to, you know, like I said, a gentleman that I never had the honor to meet in person, but I truly feel that I've gotten to know him a bit better by hearing the two of you speak of him and listening to his music. I want to pay tribute to the great spirit and creativity of Christopher Allport with one last song of his, and this is called 21.
Thank you. He would have loved you.
Thanks,
Jared. Went to college in Chicago. Met a girl down by the lake. We smoked a joint, walked home, spoke of Shelley, Keats, and Blake. She took me up and she laid me down, her body close to mine. Her kisses fresh as summer corn, sweet like apple wine. She was 21. 21, she'll always be. I think of her in April now, when the green buds swell the tree. Lost her to the highway. She was running wild and free through the Colorado night. The pickup truck that took her life was going close to Haiti, and no one saw her soul fly from the white line to the light. But she was 21. 21, she'll always be. I think of her in autumn now, when I smell the burning leaves. Kept it in a drawer. When he was just a college kid, he went off to the war. He never talked about those times. He held his wounds inside, but he gave me that purple heart on the morning that he died. When he was 21, sent him overseas. We buried him in frozen ground beneath the barren tree. Children to bed. I try to watch the news, the babble of the talking head just leaves me confused. There's a river running through this town. It's dark, it's wide, it's deep. The whisper of the river storm is calling me to sleep. When I was 21, the world was made for me. Now I hear a winter wind howling through the tree. Now I hear a winter wind howling through the tree.
And that was Christopher Allport with 21. What a beautiful song. Susan Hayden, yeah. Mason Summit, thank you both for being on the show today. What an honor and pleasure it's been to speak with the two of you.
Likewise.
Thank you, Rich.
You're so important to our community, Rich, and I can't wait to see you tonight at Library Girl and hear you perform again.
Well,
thank
speaking
you so
of
much
which,
for having us.
Yeah, well, speaking of which, I wanted to mention, can you just let the listeners know the time tonight for Library Girl, the address, and all the pertinent information?
Yes. So Library Girl is celebrating Punk Hostage Press again tonight. They've been the writer from Punk Hostage Press in there before, but it will be back tonight, some of them, including Dennis Cruz and Annette Cruz, Rich Ferguson, Iris Berry, S.A. Griffin, Richard Modiano, Carly Archibek. Who am I forgetting?
I think that's most everyone.
And that's tonight. And it's at 7 o'clock at the Ruskin. And the Ruskin Theater is 3000 Airport Avenue. It's over at the Santa Monica Airport. You can get there through, it's just south of Ocean Park off of Sentinella or Bundy, off of Bundy to Airport Avenue. And it's free parking, free dessert. It's going to be fun. It's $10. That money goes to the theater. Anybody that pays, all of that goes to keeping the theater alive there. It's a fantastic community. Well, it's not a community theater. It's an equity waiver theater, but it's an asset to this community here. And I hope that everybody will come out. And Mason Summit will be opening the show, as he always does. And excited. Thank you so much for having us, Rich.
Yeah, well, thanks to both of you, and I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire, C-Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when I'll be featuring writer, raconteur, rock musician, and lead vocalist for the punk band TSOL, Jack Grisham. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape. No!